So today, I'm very excited about this lecture because this is a lecture that I made up on my own that you don't really usually find in a course like this. And so today's lecture is called The Origin and Creation of Life. So it's kind of two parts. And actually, the first part is much shorter, but the origin of life is basically how life comes about. So how do you get life in the first place from basic chemicals? So we're talking about the early evolution of Earth and how life came about in that process. And then the second part is about actually how we create life. So in general, how animals create life, but also we're going to concentrate on human beings and how life gets created. So the process of pregnancy and also the process of giving birth, right? So there are two different things, but I like to group them together because the idea is that how life evolved in the first place, that kind of contributes to thinking about how life kind of reproduces itself. So this is like related theme, and I wanted to kind of put them together. Okay, so first, let's talk about what is life. So in the first lecture on chemistry, we talked a little bit about how you can actually get complex molecules out. And the complex molecules that we're talking about are eventually going to be DNA, but first of all, you need carbon-based compounds, and you need amino acids, which are the components of proteins, right? And so one of the first attempts to do that is this guy, Wöhler, right? So he's a chemist, and basically he was the first person to synthesize basically carbon-based compounds. In this case, he made a very cool thing that you can actually see all the time when you go to the bathroom, and it's called urea. That's the first organic compound, guys. Urea. How cool is that, right? How cool is it to have urea, you know, like pee, you know, engraved on your tombstone at your death, right? This is great. So if you ever go to somewhere in Germany, I can't remember which city this is, but you can visit his statue, and in front of it, you're going to see the molecular structure of pee there, and you can have a picture with the molecular structure of pee. And but it is the first synthesized organic compound, okay? So the way he made it, you don't have to know the particular process, but he put ammonia with cyanic acid, it becomes a different compound, and then eventually it takes a little bit of time, then it becomes urea. So he puts it in a test tube, and you know, basically this is the process, right? But it is significant because if you think about it, these are not compounds that are in life per se, right? These two. And from these two, you can actually get something that is very biological, right? So he's credited with doing that. Now, that doesn't mean that urea evolved from, you know, ammonium, right? You know, so like, this just says that we can synthesize it, but how would it actually come about in evolution or in the Earth time? That still was not known. And so that came with the next set of kind of investigations. So these guys, Miller and Urey, what they did is they asked, well, can we basically make a model system, right? Can we simulate the Earth and how it came about in the first place? And you can have these very simple molecules and see if they can actually, using this model, come up with some more complicated compounds, right? So this is the apparatus that they use, right? So first you have this ocean, right? These are all models now, right? Think SimCity now, right? So SimEarth. So SimEarth, you have this ocean. So what's an ocean? Even in the early Earth, it's water. Now, in the early Earth, we know that, you know, a lot of times it was a lot hotter than it was. So you have these kind of gas that simulate the temperature, right? And then you have evaporation of this water vapor, and this is simulating the atmosphere. Now, in the early Earth, we know that there were a lot of like lightning-type events, right? So what they did was they hooked up some electrodes and gave them some sparks, right? So these sparks are in the atmosphere, and in the sparks will lead to a condenser. So the condenser, what that means is that these guys are still vapor, but the condenser will condense it back to liquid. It's the process of condensation. That's what it means, is to go from the gas back to the liquid form. So in the atmosphere, of course, there's other gases as well, right? That's in addition to this water, right? So CH4, NH3, etc. And then the condenser, you're going back to the liquid. And then the liquid, how the condenser works is just that in this case, they just apply cold water. But anything cold is fine, right? Because if you cool things down, there's a phase change, so it becomes from the gas back to liquid. If you cool it even further, it becomes ice. In this case, they just went to water. So, and then the water goes back to the ocean, and then in the ocean, now you just kind of, in the process of going to the ocean, you just kind of drop a little bit out and take a look at what chemicals are in there, right? So over time, so you run this model, the SimEarth model, constantly, and then over time you kind of look at the sample and see what's actually there. Now, when you actually do this, just from the process of the lightning sparks and kind of this evaporative cooling process, you can actually make some very interesting things, right? You can make formaldehyde, HCN, amino acids actually can come out, right? So they didn't come up with complicated amino acids. You know, they came up with like valine and, you know, kind of these smaller chain amino acids. But the idea is that eventually you can get from these short chains to the longer chains as well. Okay? So they got some amino acids, they got some carbon chains, right? So that's probably from a methane gas from the spark being able to join longer chains, right? So you can go to ethane and even longer ones, right? Many multiple carbons. So the idea is that, well, you can get life-based molecules from this process. And so that's kind of a breakthrough, because the idea was that, well, you know, you can get very life-like structures. Now, this model is limited, right? Because from here, you're not getting RNA and DNA type of stuff. You're not getting nucleic acid types of complicated stuff yet. You're able to get amino acids, you're able to get hydrocarbons, so carbon chains. But the next step, how does those things evolve, is still not quite known. So the idea is that this takes us to the idea that you're able probably to get lipids and get cell membranes, but how you actually get genetic material, that's still a question. There are other future experiments that kind of went into this further, but this was kind of the first one to look at how life could have originated. Okay, so this is the shortest part of all lectures, because look, here's a review. So while you guys are awake, I want to give you the quick review. So hopefully you remember what I said, because, you know, this is just exactly what I said, more or less, okay? So why don't you guys take a look? You can also talk amongst yourselves, if you like. I know it's kind of early, okay? And then maybe while as you're doing this, I want to take roll. So let's see, because you guys can still see this. Ooh, that's going to be hard. Okay, give me a second here. Okay. Do you guys know the first one? Is it? Everybody knows the first one, right? Does everybody not know the first one? I just kind of, you know, gave the peace spiel, so you guys should all know the Yeah. So think about what the second one is, although I kind of talked about it, and I'm going to take well early roll to there. Yuichiro, not here. Yushan, here. Leia. Jennifer. Kola. Sakura. Ingrid. Akari. Akemi. Junji. Makoto. Makoto. Aigerin. They probably figure they can come late, right? Because I'm taking roll later. Sayaka is here. But you guys are lucky you guys are here. Then? Okay. Yuri? No. Aoi? No. Shinji? No. Susanna? Not here yet. Minho? Okay. Alexander? Okay. Yinjun? Okay. Cool. Okay, so the second one, has anybody kind of talked about in the slides a little bit? I have Miyagi, so whoever gets it right from China. So, sorry, what's your name again?
Makoto,
right? It's okay. No, I just took roles, so I wanted to for you on there because you just came just in time. Makoto Sato, right?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Anybody want to try to answer this one? Which of the following molecule was not found by Miller and Urey? Oh, your choice of.
The list is sweet. From Yunnan, China, perfect. I don't know. So these are kind of like stall. They're not chewy, they're just kind of stall. It's called, since we're doing life sciences, it's called like the 18 different. How do you say, monsters of Yunnan? Is this, I don't know why they call it that. Because it's just, you know, different, I guess. That's what it says here. I just got it, so it's fine. So, and then these are kind of more candy type things. Okay. Just pick anything you want. Oh. All right. There will be more opportunity later, guys. I know you guys want this. Okay, like so just like what Ingrid said and what I said before is also that what they could not see was RNA and DNA, right? That was not, you know, found yet. So actually, I failed to mention, but they actually found different types of amino acids too. So remember that in the humans and animals mostly, you're looking at left-handed ones, right, in the body. So somehow they found both ones, and the question is how you get from one to the other. Why is only one predominant over the other? So that's also we don't know much about. But anyway, so that's the answer. So for the remaining of this lecture, I'm going to concentrate on life itself. So in particular, mostly human life, right? So how the process of birth comes about, how do you create life? So we know that evolution came up with this strategy. So somehow Mother Earth is now able to give birth to us. The question now is that to us, how do we propagate, you know, this thing that's given to us? What's the process by which we give birth, right? So this is what I'll talk about. So first, I would want to talk about reproduction in general, right? So there are two kind of main types of reproduction. One is asexual and one is sexual, right? So going back to the more general animal realm, right? So asexual reproduction, you're looking only at mitosis. So this is why I did the life cycle lecture before, because remember, mitosis, you're just doing copies, right? You don't have any genetic recombination going on. So on the left side, asexual reproduction just means that it's similar to mitosis in the sense that you're reproducing all the kind of cells in your body. In this case, you're reproducing copies of yourself, right? But in sexual reproduction, it's different in the sense that mitosis gives you two copies each time, and this kind of amplifies, right? Because if each one gives you two copies, very quickly you have a lot of offsprings. But in asexual reproduction, that doesn't necessarily happen because the female has to be inseminated. So that just means the genetic information from the male has to get through, okay? And then it's able to give a limited number of offsprings, and those offsprings can now go through generations. But usually, they don't give as much, right, offspring. But the advantage, of course, is that genetic information is changing all the time. So if you have environmental pressures, the sexual reproduction is going to be able to take advantage of changes in the environment. Okay? So I'll say that more carefully in a couple of slides from now. But okay. But just remember that, sexual reproduction, they are optimized for different things. The asexual reproduction allows you to reproduce very quickly. So if you're in a very stable environment, boom, you have lots of offspring being able to kind of distribute in that area. But for sexual reproduction, it's able to take advantage of changes in the environment because there's genetic changes. So if you have genetic changes, that means you're able to acclimatize, adapt to any new environment. So even if you have radical changes in the environment, the sexual reproduction will still likely come up with some new genetically identified individual that will still be able to survive in a different environment. Okay? I'll say that again in the future. So there are two different modes for different times of life, I guess. Right. Okay, so we didn't talk about meiosis, right? But I don't want you guys to be caught up in kind of the very detailed process of meiosis. I will just talk about it in this slide, right? So remember mitosis, what we talked about last time, and that's just reproduction of these individuals, right? So you just copy these guys, you line them up during metaphase, and then you just divide them into two. And then eventually, these guys are all going to make copies of their own DNA in these chromosomes and then do it again. Okay, so mitosis is clear, right? So in meiosis, it's a little bit different, right? So meiosis, first of all, you have to, after doing the chromosome replication, you have to line up these kind of parental pairs, right? And then, so what that means is that the genetic information from the mom and the dad are actually going to line up and kind of cross over. The idea is that basically you have genetic recombination. What that means is that over time, that chromosome is not going to stay the same. It's going to be exchanging information. That's the key. I mean, the detail doesn't matter as much, but the idea is that you're exchanging information, right? And then during the metaphase, what happens is that you line these guys up, and then you actually divide out the chromosomes themselves, okay? So you take out the two chromosomes, and then, so what that means is that each individual offspring at this phase is actually consists of individual chromosomes, and then individual chromosomes actually get divided further. So what that means is that previously 2N duplicate is now going to be getting to 1N. So you can think of that as basically the genetic information from the mom and dad recombinated gets divided up. It's kind of like that. Okay. So, but the idea is that basically you're getting 2N of two end at the end of mitosis, which is what you usually have, versus one end. So kind of one chromosome, like you left one chromosome as opposed to the pair that you usually get. Okay, usually you get the pair from the parents, right? Here, you recombinate stuff, and then you get one pair each, one chromosome each at the end. But these cells are special cells. These are like, for example, sperm and egg, right? Because these are not cells that are just in the body. They're kind of sex cells, okay? They're used for reproductive purposes, okay? Does everybody more or less understand meiosis? I know I didn't give you the full detail, but we don't need to know that kind of detail. The big idea is just that you're getting one end copy of the chromosome, and so you have four of these guys as the offspring as opposed to two, right? Because you're only getting one copy of each, okay, after meiosis. But genetic recombination happened. So that's what, you know, if it's only mitosis the whole time, there's no genetic recombination. The only way you can change the DNA in that case is through random events, right? They're called mutations. If you have random events that changes the DNA, then, you know, perhaps certain offsprings might be better off and those guys might do better. But there's very limited ability to change your genetic information. But in the meiosis, there's recombination. You know, there's a lot more possibilities for changing the genes that you have in your cells. Okay. So let me go back to asexual reproduction for a second. And then we'll... And so remember, that's the mitosis part of things. There's actually different types of asexual reproduction. They're all kind of similar, but we'll talk about each one. So budding is just basically you have part of one cell actually grow, like it just comes out monster-like and budding to another individual, right? So let me see if I have a picture. Oh, no, I don't really have a picture of budding, but it's kind of like just come out. Fission is actually you divide yourself into two. So it's different from budding because fission actually you divide yourself out and then that then starts to grow back to the full self, right? Now, the more interesting stuff, for example, is this, right? Parthenogenesis. Parthenogenesis is basically what happens is that you have an egg. So an egg, remember, it's one of these one-end individuals, right? One of these single chromosome containing, single copy containing sex cell. But instead of the fertilizing the egg, it's just unfertilized. In other words, it never gets the dad, it never gets the sperm, right? It never gets the information, the other pair, right? The other end of the two end, right? But that self actually develops into an adult. So what that means is that everything is haploid. Haploid just means one end as opposed to two end. Because usually you have two end copies, one from mom and one from dad. But in this case, it's just one end individual. It's just always surviving with just a single copy of everything. It's kind of risky in some sense, right? Because if you have damage to anything in that one end, you're kind of screwed. You don't have any leftover redundancy. You don't have any copies at all. But for example, honeybee drones actually have haploid. So what that means is that certain species, actually, they just keep going as one-end individuals, right? And then parthenogenesis just means that it just means the process of this unfertilized, so in other words, never sex never happens. It just kind of keeps going, and it becomes an adult, and it'll just survive in that form, okay? What I said before last time is also asexual reproduction. Remember, is that it's advantageous when you have a stable environment. Because remember, asexual reproduction, mitosis happens very quickly because of this. One guy gives rise to two, but each one of these two guys quickly can now mitosis into two more. So at this fourth generation, you're already looking at two to the third, right, individuals. So you can reproduce very quickly. So that's advantageous if you have a stable environment, because very quickly you're going to be able to proliferate in this environment. Right? So that's the advantage of asexual reproduction. When you have a stressed environment, then the sexual reproduction is good, because if you have an environment that's changing, boom, all that mitosis occurs, doesn't matter, they all get killed. Right? So if you have, you know, some, you know, water-based environment, when the animal was never used to that, boom, all those animals get washed out, you're gone. It doesn't matter how much mitosis happens. But that's where sexual reproduction comes in, because sexual reproduction, you get more genetic changes. Now, the probability of coming up with an individual that now survives in a more water-based environment is higher. So all you need is like one or two of those guys to survive, and then they can reproduce sexually to come up with more individuals. So sexual reproduction is very useful when you have a stressed environment, which was actually most likely how the early Earth would have been, right? You have all these climate changes, and you know, so that's where sexual reproduction having evolved may have been an answer to evolutionary questions. And maybe why we have sexual reproduction ourselves and not asexual reproduction. Okay, so let me just show you a picture, a movie of what asexual reproduction looks like in Hydra. So this is the Hydra, and then what you're going to see is basically stuff budding off from the side. So this is an example of budding, and that's an individual. That's an individual hydra that's coming out from the side of the hydra. And it looks identical, except much smaller. And then, but eventually, they're just going to keep mitosis thing until you get full individuals. Yeah? Okay. I will talk about just a little bit of the details of this, but not as much as before. So it turns out there's a lot of very weird, kinky kind of sex kind of stuff going on, okay? I'm only going to talk about a little bit of this. But one example is this thing called like parthenogenic kind of sort of sex. So remember parthenogenesis, right? So this is a term you should be familiar with. Is again, there's no sex going on, right? It's just an unfertilized egg. You're just looking at one end, which is haploid, right? But for some reason, animals have this tendency where sex kind of is preferred. So what happens here is actually you have a parthenogenic animal that is kind of mimicking sex without actually sex going on. You're getting sexual behavior without actually sex. I know, it's very weird. Okay, this is what's going on. So remember, parthenogenesis is unfertilized egg, right? So if you have a female, then you get the ovary size, gets bigger and bigger, so the egg is kind of developing, right? And in that process, there are different hormones that come on, right? But in this case, what's going on is that when the progesterone hormone comes on, this animal actually becomes male-like. You know, it's as if it becomes a male. So based on whether this hormone or that hormone is predominant, the animal is going to be male or female-like. And then, when these animals are actually male versus female, they're actually going to have pseudo-sex, okay? So, guys who have high progesterone levels are going to actually, quote-unquote, mate with guys who have, girls who have high estradiol concentration. And then they're actually going to mate, but nothing actually happens. It's just parthenogenesis, because at the end of it, you're just getting an unfertilized egg, and that unfertilized egg develops into the next haploid individual. Right? So how does this develop? We don't really know, but one answer could have been if you need to go back from the sexual reproduction back to the asexual reproduction because it's more advantageous in a, you know, stable environment, maybe this is the process to go back. Okay, so the detail is not important, but I just wanted to tell you, though, that there are just a lot of really kinky, weird stuff going on. Like, evolution has come up with all kinds of stuff. I mean, this is just one example, and I don't have time to go over all kinds of different types of sex versus non-sex kind of things that can happen, but just remember that there's just all kinds of stuff going on. There's all kinds of stuff. And so don't think that kind of this, you know, heterosexual, human-like, male-female thing is like the prominent, dominant thing. It's not, you know, there's all kinds of weird stuff going on. Okay, having said that, I said I wasn't going to talk about it, but let me just talk very, very quickly, just a few things. So again, you don't have, basically you don't have to know this. This is just, you know, sexual education, 101 for fun, right? So first there's hermaphrodites, right? Hermaphrodites are basically, they have both male and female sex organs. You kind of see that in like Greek myth, basically, you know. So you can kind of see that, you know, somehow in humans. But they have, so basically they have both, I guess I'm allowed to say certain words in this class. They have both like penises and vaginas, basically, okay? So they also produce both eggs and sperm. And so sometimes they actually can mate with themselves. Okay, we'll move on. That's it. Okay, sexual reversals. That's also interesting. So in this case, it's that you actually have females who can become a male, right? So most likely this is in the case where you have lots of females in the group, and then the biggest female, by hormonal changes, now becomes the next male if the previous male dies. Yeah, I know, it's weird, right? But I'm telling you, weird shit happens, okay? So that male now is going to impregnate all the females, right? And then when that male is done, gone, the next biggest female comes on. Sexual reversals. They can actually change their sex. All right. This is the fun part of the lecture. You guys are all engaged. External fertilization, that's not quite as weird, although we don't do it. But, so, you know, like frogs do this, right? So you release the eggs into the environment. And then in the environment, like in the water or in the pond or whatever, the males can actually go in and fertilize them, or they can actually release sperm into that environment as well and just hope that things work out, right? This is kind of an interesting thing too, right? Like frogs, right? You just release a bunch of eggs there. They sense chemically where these guys are, and then the sperms just come in as a wave. So the thing is that you have to produce lots of these because it's external. That means the environment is going to kill off like 80% of the stuff, 80% of your haploid sex cells that are out there. But you just go by numbers, right? It's different from human beings. Human beings, we don't produce like shitload of babies and hope some of them survive. That's not how it happens. Okay? So that's external fertilization. And it turns out in the animal kingdom or in life in general, monogamy is actually pretty rare. So like the monogamy that we have, which monogamy just means you have one male, one female producing offspring, that kind of thing, is actually pretty rare. It turns out there's also some very interesting strategies for overcoming this. Because monogamy is rare, what that means is that most likely a male is going to impregnate a bunch of different females, because that's going to give you high probability of your genetic information being able to survive, right? Because if you impregnate more than one female, then more likely your genetic information will live on somewhere else, even if that offspring doesn't survive. But what that means is also that you're not able to identify that this is really your child as well. Because think about it, if you impregnate lots of females as a male, then other males are also going to impregnate lots of females. Then for a given female, how do you know that this is my, you know, this particular male's child? So some species come up with a strategy where the female actually becomes less receptive after having been impregnated. So in other words, they have sex, and then if they have sex, they kind of just like, oh, you know, they don't like it, quote-unquote, anymore. Right? So that also happens. And that is a solution for kind of lack of monogamy. But anyway, I mean, these are all just fun stuff. But the idea is just that there's no absolute right or kind of perfect way of doing things. The human way is just one of many different ways that evolved in the animal kingdom. Okay. Okay, I think we're okay on time. Okay, so again, this is, we don't have to know a lot of detail for this, so you guys don't have to kind of know all these terms, but in the fruit fly, I wanted to talk about kind of before going to animals a little bit. In the fruit fly, you have the following strategy as well, and also kind of interesting strategy, is that they actually store the sperm in these things called spermatica is a single. So what that means is that you put them in these little structures, and then they're only going to be released when the conditions are favorable, right? So that's also a little bit different because you're putting them in here, and then when it's actually favorable, then you actually use it to, in this case, actually impregnate yourself. So in other words, you get these kind of sperm from the male fruit fly whenever you can, and then you store them, and then when you're ready, then you use them on your egg. It's weird, right? That's also pretty weird, right? So, I mean, that also kind of makes sense because if you don't have easy way to have sex, basically, then what you want is you want to trick the male to give you lots of sperm first. You store it, and then it's like when you're ready, then you're going to use it. Right? It's not the way humans do it, I know, but that's just another way. Okay? All right. So now we're going to go talk about human beings, right? So hopefully you guys are not shy. I mean, these are not like, this is just biology, okay? So first we talk about males, then we talk about females. Okay? So, again, in terms of the terms, you don't have to know kind of every detail. I'll just highlight what you kind of more or less should know in terms of the structures. And so human beings, we have the primary organ for sexual purposes is this penis, right? So, but what happens is that first you need to make the sperm, right? The sperm is made in these structures called the seminiferous tubules, right? So these are, the seminiferous tubules are kind of right here. They're found inside this testis, right? So testes are kind of this, the ball thing, okay? And so what they do is that they kind of travel through this thing called epididymis, and then in the epididymis and also in the testis, it's actually being cooled. So remember, this is a storing thing, right? You keep them cool, you keep your sperm nice and fresh, and then eventually, they're going to come through this thing called vas deferens, and then you have a bunch of glands that I will talk about later that basically produce different chemicals that mix in with your sperm. So it's not just sperm. It'll give the sperm nutrition, for example. And then when it's ready, it's going to, when I say ready, that means like during sex, when it gets released, it will actually come out through this tube and actually gets released through the penis. Okay? But anyways, it's the main thing is just that, you know, the sperm is made in seminiferous tubules and stored until it's ready. Okay. So, again, so it turns out they're kind of 2 or 3 weeks is the time frame for the production of the sperm. And then when they're ejaculated, which just means they're released, they go through the vas deferens, which is this tube that you see before, and then gets released. Okay, so these are the same structure. I'll just talk about the same thing over again. Again, sperm gets produced here, right? Seminiferous tubules and the testes. Testes is the thing that contains the seminiferous tubules. And then the epididymis, again, is this in-between structure that where some of the combination happens as well, where the different substances that mix in with the sperm also happens. And again, the vas deferens goes through here, And actually, it turns out that you also have different glands going through. So for example, you have the parathyroid gland here, and that produces some substances, sugars, for example, that is mixed in with the sperm, and also the prostate as well. Okay. Let me talk about now what we actually need to know from that picture. Okay. So the seminal vesicles, so I'm sorry, this might be a little bit confusing. So the seminiferous tubules are stuff going on in here. Okay? The seminal vesicles now, the seminal vesicles are actually over here. These are two different things. I'm sorry it's confusing, but there's just many things going on. But everything I talked about up to this point are just structures. You don't have to know the name for them. From here on, I'm just giving you different ways of basically modifying the sperm, basically. And so these are three different glands, right? One is seminal vesicles. One is prostate here. One is parathyroid. These are, again, really just names, but they're just glands that produce different things that mixed in with the sperm. Okay, so now I'm not talking about structures in particular. I'm talking about really about what you need to put along with the sperm. So for example, the seminal vesicles, they produce this kind of alkaline, so like mucus-like thing, so it's kind of coagulant. They produce fructose. They produce this thing called prostaglandins, which are kind of immune-like substances. And again, that kind of protects the sperm from immunological damage. So if you have bacteria and things like that. So you mix all these things and you put them together with the sperm, and that becomes what is called semen, which contains the sperm. Okay. The prostate also does similar thing, but mainly what it does is produce citrate that also provides nutrient to the sperm. And of course, for males, human males, there's a risk of the cancer in this particular area just because cells reproduce very quickly in that area. There's another different gland that actually puts in different things. So this one is kind of right before ejaculation is where it comes on. So there basically it produces some basic chemicals that helps to neutralize the urine, because remember, males are actually going to use the same pathway basically for sex and for, you know, peeing. Okay, I was just saying. So what that means is that you want to clear yourself of, you know, urine, you know, urea, before you use it for other things, right? Okay. So anyways, these are all basically producing different things that mixed in with the sperm. The important one is actually seminal vesicles, because that's going to provide some nutrients, provide some immunological protection, a way of also coagulating, which just means thickening the sperm, or the fluid around the sperm. So now, when actually sex actually happens, you have this kind of, the penis gets erect, and then it kind of, when it's ready, it kind of ejaculates the sperm. So you guys might have heard of Viagra, because it stills, I just wanted to tell you like what it actually means. Okay, so you see Viagra commercial and that's supposed to work some magic, right? But it turns out it's just a chemical, and it's actually a muscle relaxation chemical. That's all it is. Okay, it's actually just nitric oxide containing chemical. You release it in the right place, it relaxes the muscles so that it's just kind of more ready for when you have the erection. So that's what actually Viagra is just nitric oxide. Nitric oxide, I should say, manipulating the nitric oxide. It's not nitric oxide, it's a chemical that manipulates that pathway. Okay. Alright, so now let's talk about females. Okay. So in females, instead of what we talked about earlier, you have, in females, what you want to do is you protect your eggs, okay? That's the key with females. Why? Because there are lots of eggs produced early in the female's life, and you store them. At a certain age, females are not going to produce more eggs. So you want to keep them in a safe place. But what happens is that you're actually going to kind of release eggs periodically. Okay? The reason is because that gives you certain times in the life of the female where it's susceptible to sexual reproduction. Right? When the egg's ready, only when the egg is ready, when then you have the sperm coming in and giving it the other half of the genetic information to give you new offspring. Okay? So what the females are going to do is going to keep these eggs in places called ovaries, right? And then every month or so, depending on the particular female, you're going to release that egg and it's going to go through this oviduct, right? Oviduct into the uterus, right? Uterus is where the insemination, so the impregnation basically. Insemination just means the sperm coming together with the egg, where that would theoretically possibly happen. It doesn't necessarily happen, but if it does, it happens there. If it does happen, then the baby is going to start developing here. Endometrium is just this muscle that kind of protects the baby if it turns out that you're getting impregnated at that point. And if you do get an individual, then eventually it grows here, and when it's ready, it comes out through the cervix and the vagina. Okay. similar. You don't have to know these other terms. Sorry, I should have changed those. the key thing is that you have ovaries. The ovaries where you have the development of the egg. When it's ready, it goes through the oviduct. So it goes through the oviduct and into the uterus. The uterus is basically the primary organ. If you're getting insemination with the sperm, then the baby is going to develop in the uterus. If it doesn't, it just goes through. Okay, that's why you have these monthly or so processes, right? Period is what it's called, where the egg needs to be released, you know, if it wasn't previously impregnated, which I guess for most of us would not actually happen most of the time. Okay, and the other thing that's so important. So, a couple of things. So, more or less just for your information. So, you have also glands in the females also that produces chemicals, just like in the males. In the females, you have these vestibular glands, and let me see if it's in this picture. It's not in this picture, but they produce some also kind of coagulating types of substances and helps to with the lubrication of the female sex organs. And then you have this thing called the endometrium, which you should know endometrium. So endometrium is actually pretty vital. It's the lining of the uterus. So remember, the uterus is here, and the kind of the layer on top of it is called the endometrium. It's filled with blood, and if the egg gets through into that area, it's going to help nourish the egg, prepare for insemination, and is able to kind of help nourish it, provide it with nutrients. Okay, it goes all the way through to the cervix. Okay, the clitoris is just the very outermost part, and so that's the part that gets sensitive and it gets aroused during sex, and then the penetration comes in here, and then the male sperm goes all the way inside here, and it gets the insemination process takes place inside. Okay. Females, turns out, also have these thin tissue called the hymen, which is kind of on the outer surface, and that actually is intact until the first time the female has sex. So basically that gets ruptured. This is why it could possibly be bloody the first time the females have sex. And then there's also other glands that produce milk, and that's a separate thing that's not anything to do with this area per se. For example, you have plants that produce milk as well, and that also is regulated by hormones. Okay. I know I gave you a lot of information there. Again, you don't have to know the very specific detail of exactly which gland does what and stuff like that. It's just kind of for your information. And also for you to kind of look at it and say, wow, there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of intricate details in the sexual organs of males and females just for reproduction. Okay, now I'll talk about how you actually get these individual sex cells that you're going to eventually use for reproductive processes. So first, for the males, you have this spermatogenesis, right? So that just means generating the sperm. Remember, this is happening within this seminiferous tubules, which are found inside the testis. There's a lot of terms, and you don't have to know them. And it's kind of, you know, like for example, epididymis is different from endometrium, right? this is a game, okay? I taught this many times, so I remember. But you guys, it's okay if you don't remember. Okay, so again, they take place inside this seminiferous tubules, right? So the idea basically is though that you have different cells that are inside this area, and as the sperm cell goes through this layer, it becomes differentiated into the ultimate sperm cell that you need. So because remember, at the beginning of meiosis, you're just having these one-end cells. But as it goes through the seminiferous tubules and through this modulation with different types of compounds that's going on, basically you have these cells being maturated. So for example, it adds a little head, it adds a little tail, etc., etc., and eventually at the end of this process you get sperm cells. And it's found in the inside area of the seminiferous tubules, going from the outside, going into the inside. Once it's ready, you can find these guys swimming around, right? So now it's kind of ready to go through stuff, right? This is what a sperm cell looks like. Really, again, these terms don't matter. The only thing is probably maybe the acrosome, because the acrosome is the kind of the front head of the sperm, and so it's going to release certain chemicals to be able to penetrate the layer that surrounds the egg. Okay? So again, you're going from two end to one end. Meiosis is happening throughout this process of going from the outside of the seminiferous tubule to the inside. At the end of it, though, is you're getting these sperm cells, and it has a flagella, or these little tail things, and it's ready to go through stuff. It's almost like it's all individuals, right? It has its own mitochondria, everything. So this is what human sperm cells look like, flapping around like little tadpoles. Okay, that's not an egg. That's just a pipette. Okay. So now the female generation process. So in females, remember, women need to protect their eggs. Because the eggs that they have, that's all they're going to have for the most part. You're not going to get new eggs, right? So everything is found in this kind of quote-unquote follicle form. And eventually, these egg cells are going to be used and then released through the oviduct, kind of on a monthly cycle, right? So again, oogenesis is the generation of eggs, right? So basically, there's these hormones. I will talk a little bit more later, but it's called FSH, my follicle-stimulating hormone. Just FSH is okay. FSH stimulates the growth of the follicle, and so this is why possibly women have kind of swings in moods as well, because they need to generate hormones on this kind of cycle, monthly cycle. In this case, these hormones, once a month, is going to generate the development of an egg, and this egg is actually, again, this is just, you know, this is nothing other than just meiosis. And then eventually, the thing that we call period is basically after ovulation, and you need to release the unwanted egg. But the ovulation process is basically this egg being ready, and then if it's ready, then the sperm, if it enters, allows you to actually have a fertilized egg. Okay, I know there's a lot of terms, but okay, we'll go through it in more detail. So again, before the woman even comes out, a lot of eggs are already there, right? So at puberty, you have a lot of mature follicles now, right? These, remember, before, they're just follicles that are not developed. And when you have the FSH come on at a certain age, these follicles are actually developed into eggs, and the egg is actually going to be eventually ovulated. That just means released from this area through ovulation and goes through the oviduct and goes into the uterus. So here is actually the uterus, right? So the ovulation process is the egg coming out through the oviduct into the uterus area, okay? It turns out the follicle actually develops further into a different material. It's called corpus luteum, right? So you can think of the corpus luteum as kind of developing in the uterus, basically, in the endometrium area, that layer that's covering the uterus. And then that thing, this complicated kind of covering, is actually now going to be ready to secrete different hormones. And these hormones are actually going to prepare the uterus, right, the endometrium, to get ready for your egg and also the sperm coming in, and also to be able to get you ready for in case the sperm enters. Now, if the sperm doesn't enter, then this corpus luteum is just going to degenerate. And so this is the stuff that happens in the period, because you need to get rid of all this extra stuff that you don't want in case it never happens. And it's just the degeneration of this corpus luteum. All this tissue needs to come out. This is what period happens. Okay? I know there's a lot of examples. But. So the basic process is pretty simple, though. The basic process is eggs through ovulation. The egg comes out, right? You need to get through. And if that egg develops further, corpus luteum develops any case, right, to help protect the egg. But if the egg goes further, which means it was inseminated with a sperm, then other things happen. Okay? If it doesn't, stuff generate, you get rid of it. Okay, so that's the short story. Okay, and then the next thing we talk about is just how you regulate this process. And it turns out there's a lot of hormones that are involved. Okay, so let me talk about this. So, again, you don't have to know all these hormones. So probably, follicle stimulating hormone is probably knowable, because that's the thing that you develop your, you stimulate your follicles into eggs that are ready. But other than that, maybe the estrogens, right? Because those are kind of the female hormones. But anyway, okay, I'll tell you which ones you should know. So first of all, there are also hormones that go from the human brain in an area called the hypothalamus to actually direct this other area called the pituitary gland that actually itself generates these other hormones. Okay, so first there's a process from the brain that directs other glands to generate hormones. Right, so it's coming in from the hypothalamus. Hypothalamus tells the pituitary glands to generate this and this and this. Okay, so that's first of all. And then from the pituitary now, you're actually going to produce these other things, right? The main ones are, again, FSH and LH, right? The FSH and LH, so for the FSH, in addition to stimulating the growth of your follicle into a mature egg, it also now stimulates other hormones to do other stuff as well. Okay? So for example, you have the two kind of pretty famous kind of hormones, right? It turns out both males and females have them, okay? But we have different proportions, right? So forget about the first word in here. So the easiest one to know is just testosterone, which is kind of this male hormone, right? It's part of the English language now. When you say testosterone, that means like you know, you're getting it on, you know, you're like, you're ready, you're a male hormone. So what that does is that in male individuals, and, well, I guess in female individuals as well, it contributes to these kind of male-like characteristics throughout development. So this is like in the future when the baby gets born, for example, it gives you the lower voice, it gives you the facial hair, it stimulates different parts of the body to do different things. Aggressiveness also has certain tendencies, because if you have high levels of this hormone in the brain, it kind of, you know, gives you some behavioral properties, right? It also contributes to generation of sperm within the seminiferous tubules, okay? And then there's also female-like hormones, right? And so in this case, estrogens like estradiol, and that will stimulate the growth of breasts, deposit of fats, etc., etc. Okay. So it turns out, actually, though, female individuals, if you give them too much testosterone, will actually get male-like characteristics, and vice versa for males as well. Okay. All right. So here's really the key thing that you should take away from this lecture. I know I gave you a lot of details, but here is the kind of, you know, not having to know the individual cells here, but knowing the general concept that this whole system is regulated in a feedback process. That's what you should know. What do I mean by feedback? Feedback just means that whatever you produce at the end comes back to the beginning of your process to help regulate. Okay, so let me go through it step by step. Remember what I said is that the brain, the hypothalamus, produces chemicals that now is going to tell the pituitary gland to produce these other hormones. These other hormones is actually going to go through to other cell types, and those other cell types are now going to produce other hormones, right? And those other hormones are actually going to go into the actual cells themselves to actually do things, right? So I'm giving you the example of the male system in this case, right? So the male system goes like this, right? Hypothalamus tells the pituitary, remember, so actually FSH is in males and females as well. So this is kind of interesting as well. But they do different things, completely different things. Because an FSH is actually now going to help you produce sperm, right? So it goes through these particular cell type, which is in the seminiferous tubules. So I put in a little box here, because everything here is basically in the seminiferous tubules, which are in the testes. And these cell types are different cells that are actually going to produce different hormones. For example, testosterone. It produces other stuff as well, but the main thing is testosterone. But what if you have too much of this, right? How do you regulate how much hormone you need? Because remember, you have too much of something, you're going to, you know, too aggressive, for example, right? Or you're generating too much characteristics that you don't want. Well, what happens is that there's a negative feedback. This hormone is actually going to go back, when there's too many of this, it's actually going to go back and inhibit the previous gland, right? How does it do this? The way it does is that this pituitary, and also in the case of testosterone, also in the hypothalamus, in those brain areas and also in the pituitary, you actually have receptors that fit the testosterone. But these receptors are inhibitory, right? So when the testosterone is bound to this receptor, is it going to inhibit the production of future hormones? Now, it's going to inhibit the production of FSH and LH, right? So it doesn't inhibit itself, but it inhibits further step before. Or in the case of hypothalamus, it actually inhibits even further step before that. But in either case, it's going to slow this process, slow the production. So what that means is that the body is going to reach an equilibrium level which is appropriate for the body. So you have a negative feedback system, okay, in the male. Okay, so inhibition actually mostly just does inhibition. So if you notice, actually, you know, testosterone does its stuff, right? But it turns out you need to produce stuff that only just inhibit. That's pretty cool, right? Because all this stuff is just to control the appropriate level that you have. There's all this complicated stuff going on. Only a few of the hormones actually does stuff. Most of this stuff is actually going back and kind of regulating, okay, this is too much, you know, stop it, calm down. So this is what the male reproductive system is, sorry, the male, you know, sperm generation sex system is doing. It's actually having negative feedback. Because males, they can go off at any time, okay? They have too much testosterone. You don't have to worry about males having too much testosterone unless you're like 70. So what that means is that you want to control this process, negative feedback. Turns out females differ, okay? So this is actually the kind of thing I want you guys to take away, not the other previous anatomy type stuff. But in the female, you have the negative feedback, which is what I will talk about. But it turns out you also have positive feedback. I will talk about that later. But first, I talk about negative feedback. Okay? So in the female, first you also have negative feedback. Okay? So how does the negative feedback work? Very similar to the male in some sense. Right? So again, the hypothalamus produces stuff. Then the intuitive pituitary produces stuff. FSH and LH. In this case, the FSH is going to stimulate the maturation of the egg, in this case, right? The LH also contributes, but anyhow, it gets to a certain phase, the follicular phase. So this is the ovulation stage. At the ovulation stage, you have these guys' hormone coming up in the right kind of concentrations to allow you to have the ovulation process happens, which is the egg getting released into the oviduct and that whole process. But eventually, you know, everything goes back down because you're not going to use the egg, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So again, these hormones that you eventually release, right, so which actually goes in and actually stimulates the production of further hormones, which are, in this case, estradiol and progesterone. So in this slide, if you take out testosterone and you replace it with estradiol, for example, basically that's what's going on. And these hormones now are going to go back and inhibit, right? So before ovulation, it's still negative feedback. Okay, so let me say that clearly now. Before this ovulation happens, it's still negative feedback. Because whatever hormones you produce out, right, which is in this case going to be estradiol and progesterone, it comes back and inhibits, right? Remember, low levels of estradiol, it's going to be low levels of estradiol because there's going to be low level of FSH. That is going to inhibit the pituitary, it's not going to produce too much, et cetera, et cetera. Right. Now, here's where the positive feedback area works, right? The positive feedback... Actually, let me see if this... Yeah, actually, maybe we just... Put. So the process, the positive part of it actually happens like this. The process... So the FSH and the LH is always going to stimulate the growth of this follicle. When the follicle gets into a large enough size, right, there's going to be enough estradiol, right? So remember, here it was always low estradiol, right? This is the female hormone, remember, the main female hormone. But if you get enough estradiol, which comes out from the follicle, now it's going to change to the positive feedback. So what positive feedback means is that increasing amounts of estradiol, mostly by this, right, high level of estradiol, positive. This is the arrow that we haven't seen before. Here was all negative, right? This positive area is going to tell the hypothalamus to produce even more, right? That's the difference. When you have high levels of estradiol, it actually tells you to produce more. Before, it was always, okay, Don't produce too much. We have enough estradiol. Don't worry about it. But when the follicle gets matured enough to be ready to be an egg, to be ovulated, high levels of estradiol gets produced. But that high level now is going to produce more estradiol because it's going to go through this process. You're going to produce more FSH, more FSH and LH. LH gets really high, actually. It's going to produce more estradiol. Estradiol goes back positive. That's the difference between the positive and the negative feedback. The negative feedback says, if I have too much product, I'm going to inhibit and tells you not to do too much. Positive feedback means when I have more of that chemical, it tells the producers to actually produce more. So that's why it's positive feedback. That's the thing that you don't get in the male system. Okay, I know it's not taught usually this way, but this is really the main idea that you need to get out, is that the system in which this process is being controlled is different for the male and the female. The organs are different, but that's not the key thing. The key thing is the system. If you look at it as an engineering system, it's different. The male is always just producing sperm. So just stop, like, don't too much, okay? That's all you need to do. The male, now the female, you need to have process in which you're having an egg once a month. So that's a fundamental different thing that you need to do. And so how do you do that? Well, you just have a development of this follicle, and when the follicle is ready, it's always producing estradiol, right? But when it's ready, it's going to produce more estradiol because it's a bigger, more mature follicle. But that estradiol level now, because of the receptors here being different, right, is actually now going to produce even more. It's going to peak, and it's going to allow you to produce even more LH. And the LH, the reason it's called LH is basically luteinizing hormone gets you ready for this kind of ovulation process. Now, the FSH also peaks a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, it's not really important. The important thing is that those hormones are now going to be positive feedback cycle, which means more and more produced, and you're just, boom, going haywire. Right? Because of this, now you're able to trigger ovulation because you have lots of these hormones sitting around, for example, the LH. And then post-ovulation, this guy is going to be implanted in the uterus. So remember, after ovulation, there's this oviduct thing that's not shown here, but it's going to go through to the uterus, the corpus luteum. Corpus luteum is the thing that surrounds that egg and helps provide nutrient for it in the endometrium of the uterus. Okay, so now if you're not getting pregnancy happens, what happens is that post the positive feedback, so after this egg gets released and goes here, well, remember, the follicle is not there anymore, estradiol decreases. When it's low estradiol level, remember, it inhibits, right, the pituitary. If it inhibits the pituitary, LH level goes down, FSH level goes down, back to negative feedback. Okay, so you have these peaks, and then comes back. Okay, and then also estradiol and progesterone level also comes back down because everything gets back to normal, negative feedback. And if pregnancy does not happen, then remember the corpus luteum doesn't do anything. The egg gets released eventually, so this guy just gets absorbed and then gets released in the period. Right. So. Again, this is called the female ovarian cycle. Very interesting, unlike the male, which is not very interesting at all. There's not much going on in the male. In the female, it's very interesting. You have this ovarian process, this kind of roughly monthly cycle. Okay, slightly less than a month, I guess. Again, I'll just talk about exactly what it is in a different slide. Oh, yes, question. No, the cell is still there. What do you mean in the middle? Oh, I see. Good question. So what happened, basically, what's the fate of the egg, right? Yeah. So the egg actually, remember, this is all happening in the ovaries, right? So in the process of ovulation, actually the egg gets released. And so again, you need a large amount of these hormones, right? Remember, look, estradiol goes all the way up in order for this process to happen. But actually, the hormone that triggers this is actually LH. So the estradiol just kind of makes the positive feedback happen. You have a LH, which actually triggers the ovulation. But post-ovulation, the egg's still there. It goes through the oviduct into the uterus, and then this is happening in the uterus. So this picture is not really perfect. You have to actually go back to this picture to really see what's going on. So remember, ovulation just means the egg comes out through the oviduct into uterus. And that is triggered by the LH. But the LH is triggered by this rise in the estradiol. So ultimately, it's kind of, you know, the follicle, as it develops, produces more estradiol. Estradiol triggers LH. LH, in a positive feedback way, that egg gets released, goes into the uterus. And then once it's in the uterus, there's no follicle anymore. The follicle becomes the corpus luteum, right? But there's no follicle-like thing in the ovaries anymore. So what that means is that you're getting the reduction in that estradiol, right? There's some subtleties here because the progesterone goes up, but you know, there's a lot of too much detail for you to, you know. What's still there? The egg? Yeah, the egg is always there. Yeah. The egg is always there. The follicle gets bigger and bigger. And that's the thing that's secreting the estradiol. So the egg is not secreting estradiol. It's the follicle around it. So it's the follicle that's nourishing the egg and helping it to mature. So as it gets bigger and bigger, more and more estradiol. More and more estradiol means more and more LH. Positive feedback triggers ovulation. Yeah. Good question. I mean, it turns out the progesterone actually stays on. It's kind of more of a complicated thing because the progesterone actually is the hormone that kind of gets your uterus ready, basically. That's why it stays on, okay? But the estradiol basically comes back down, right? Eventually, it goes all the way down. But here, it's still slightly up because the corpus luteum is still there. But eventually, if this degrades and kind of gets released, everything comes back down to normal, eventually, okay? So anyway, the key thing is that you have a positive feedback thing going on. I show you basically the same thing. Estradiol rises in the LH. LH surges, positive feedback. And this is just showing you the endometrium, which is the uterus, right? So the uterus gets ready. And then as its ovulation comes on, it gets bigger and bigger. And here, the progesterone basically helps, and the estradiol helps to kind of maintain this basically corpus luteum. Right, so of the endometrium, basically. Gets this guy ready. So it kind of stays high, but if you don't use this at all, then it gets released, and then everything comes back to normal. Okay. Okay. So menstruation is just shedding of the endometrium from the uterus, so it's basically having your period, okay? So kind of releasing that unwanted material. It turns out there are certain diseases that actually makes it so that the tissue in your uterus kind of goes into different parts of the body. That's not good. So that can happen. And the symptom is that you're going to get pain in the stomach. Okay, so hopefully you guys don't have that. Menopause, when women get to a certain age, they have this inability to respond to the FSH and the LH that's already there. So that's where you can't have eggs being ovulated anymore. So this is why, you know, women have up to a certain age until they can kind of functionally reproduce. Okay, so I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip kind of a lot of these details because this is kind of not so important. I already gave you the important detail, which is positive feedback for the female, regular control for the male, negative feedback. So why don't you guys take a look at this, and then I have a couple of slides after it, but again, those are not essential, If I have time, I'll just tell you about them as a kind of for your information kind of thing. Feel free to talk amongst yourselves. More sleep. I know most of you are cramming this information down. So I'll say, like, after this lecture, the lectures will be a little bit simpler worded as well. I tried to kind of cut out some unwanted slides from the last two lectures. Anybody have an idea how spermatogenesis and oogenesis are different? So you have to go through kind of the process of elimination. Anybody want to guess for some sweets? Anyone want to try? Guess what? What about the second one? Okay, so the first one, process of elimination, again. So oogenesis produces more than one haploid egg, right? I mean, it's producing lots of eggs. It's just that some of those are not being used, okay? It does not begin at puberty because we know women are actually born with eggs, right? And then spermatogenesis begins in embryonic stage of development. Okay, so I didn't talk like specifically about this particular thing, but again, spermatogenesis is actually going to happen throughout, right? So it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to just begin in the embryonic stage. It's going to be ready when, basically whenever, okay? So what about the last one? Oogenesis produces one egg, and spermatogenesis produces four sperm. Oh, I see. Okay. Sorry. All right. I see why this is confusing. Okay. So the first one, the difference between A and B, we eliminated B and C, right? Okay. So the difference between A and D is that here it's talking about the actual functional egg, and actually this is talking about the cell. But actually, it turns out they produce four different cells. It's just that not all of them become eggs. Okay? That's my fault. I didn't mention it kind of perfectly in that way. Because it turns out those other cells are actually called, they're called polar bodies, and they're actually not being used per se. Right? So you actually generate one egg, and that's the egg that becomes the functional one, but you actually have four cells. Okay, so let me just tell you the answer. This is the answer. You actually produce one egg, okay? But you produce four cells because meiosis always generates the four cells. Okay. I see why there's confusion. People are like, I want sweets, but I don't know what's going on here. So the answer is that you actually produce one egg, and but in spermatogenesis, of course, you always produce this four sperm. Okay, that doesn't change things. The only difference was the cell and the egg. But this one, actually, I think it was somewhat gettable, but oogenesis, when is it actually finished, right? So oogenesis is the development of the egg, okay? So that egg, actually, it turns out, is not actually really truly ready until the sperm actually enters. Because after the sperm enters, it actually triggers certain processes to actually allow the egg to mature to its full form. I guess I didn't talk about either of these. It's good that you guys are looking confused. Okay, so again, process elimination. The first one says after ovulation, but before sperm enters. That's not true because it turns out the sperm needs to enter and actually the final process in which the egg is in a mature final form is actually after the sperm enters and releases certain chemicals. Right, it's not after the nucleus fuse. That's too late. That's actually inseminate. That's actually ready. Like at that point, it's already ready to produce the next offspring. It's not prior to ovulation because actually it's still developing the egg during ovulation. And it's not during that, the embryonic development has nothing to do with it because, you know, it has nothing to do with when it's actually being developed in the human life cycle. It turns out it's actually fully completed when the egg actually penetrates the oocyte. Actually, I think I probably moved this question from the test because it was confusing, but sorry, this is a little bit confusing. Okay, let me just give you a few minor pieces of information. This is when you guys are ready to have a baby, or maybe those of you who are ready already have babies, this is what it looks like in the ultrasound image. This is the baby. And this is kind of pretty mature. This is like pretty much ready to go here. Hopefully, this is not the first time you guys are going to see this in terms of both being father and mothers in the future. This is what it looks like. They put a little tube thing into the stomach, and then this is the ultrasound that what it looks like. Okay, it's like TV. It turns out there's some subtleties in terms of what exactly happens. Again, you don't have to notice, and I don't have time to kind of go over the precise process in which this happens, but the cells are actually kind of dividing in many ways as it's going through into the uterus. I don't really have time to go through this. But the next few things is basically telling you about how the baby develops. So basically, after you have ovulation and you have insemination, how do you have the baby actually developing? And this is kind of things that happen. Basically, you need the mother to provide a gateway to help feed the baby. And that happens through this thing called placenta. That's probably the only important thing in the slide. The placenta is a bunch of blood vessels that goes through and gives the baby food and nutrients. This is why, if the mother is pregnant, you have to be very careful about what you eat, because whatever you eat is basically, and drink is important as well, is going directly to the baby. Okay, so you have to be very careful about what you have. This is how the baby develops, 5 weeks, 12 weeks, and 20 weeks, they look like human beings, right? It turns out, though, of course, that there's more positive and negative feedback control. So what I said about today, about the human systems, in the sex systems, about positive and negative feedback, it turns out it happens everywhere, in the human body, in the human brain. The positive and negative feedback control is negative feedback telling to stop because we have too much. Positive feedback means I'm ready, let's produce more, and more produces more. So positive and negative feedback happens throughout, and it turns out it also happens in the birth process, right? Stop it, you don't need to give birth yet. Estradiol says no, no, no. Oxytocin, boom, I'm ready, the baby's ready. Positive feedback stimulates contraction. Contraction produces even more oxytocin, boom, positive feedback. All right, so that's how it turns out to work. I also have a little slide here that talks about contraceptions. Very important for everybody, but I don't have time to talk about it. Okay, very important. Basically, a little bit about how different pills work and about how, if you guys are interested, look up actually how these things work, because it turns out it's a very specific process. So, for example, women who take abortion pills, they block progesterone receptors in the uterus. You know, it's a very specific thing, because the more specific it is, the more precise you're able to get about in this positive negative feedback cycle, right? It's not just like stop everything. It's a very specific process. In this case, it's stopping that progesterone from allowing you to develop into a fully ready corpus luteum, which you need to kind of get things rolling. Okay. So anyway, so that's the kind of thing. So in conclusion, I just want to say, like, if we look at both the origin of life and in the creation of life process, we have to ask ourselves, what is life, right? We looked at all the different types of sex that can happen, and then we looked at the human way of actually having very fine control. And this types of very fine control is also going to happen in the lower form of life. But how do we get to this very complicated process? What was the beginning that led to it? Well, there's all this stuff in between. So the first part of the lecture where I gave you these complex, somewhat complex molecules, and the second half of the lecture in which I told you about how it currently happened in the human being, the bridge between those two is infinitely possible, right? So that's the question of where does life originate? What is life really in that middle place, right? So you know, hopefully you guys took away from this lecture that life is really complicated, and hopefully you don't get confused too much about the different chemicals that's going on. If you know positive and negative feedback, if you know just estradiol and testosterone, that's kind of, you know, can know generally the ovarian cycle, that's enough. And I think, I'm sorry about the questions, I need to kind of refine the questions a little bit, but the second question was kind of misleading. But I'll tell you that in the exam everything will be pretty clear. Okay? Cool.